Kwame Anthony Appiah pens the Ethicist column for the New York Times and is the author of the prize-winning Cosmopolitanism, among many other works. He is a professor of philosophy and law at New York University, and his new book is The Lies That Bind, where he delves beneath the surface of our multitudinous obsession with identity, whether by creed, country, color, class, or culture. Again, the name of the book is The Lies That Bind, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Kwame Anthony Appiah to the roundtable this morning. Anthony, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure.
Very nice to have you on the program. Where did you start? The starting point for you in thinking about this was what?
Well, I suppose, like most people, probably my starting point for thinking about identity is my own life and my own dealings with identity, because I was born in London, grew up in Ghana. I'm an American citizen now, and just those growing up in those three places, almost everything about me has a different meaning in each of those places. So my mother was British, my father was Ghanaian, so I'm brown. In Ghana, that made me lighter than most people, and in England, it made me darker than most people. And so people respond to the fact that you don't look like most people around here. And so from the beginning of my life, I suppose I've been conscious of that fact, though I have to say I've always also pretty much felt at home wherever I happen to be living. But still, you think about these things because people respond to you in ways that reflect your race and their sense of where you come from. And so it's natural, if you're a philosopher as I am, to think about it in the philosopher's way, which is a little bit more complicated than maybe most people.
You write in the book, I mean, obviously the question that you were so often asked is, where are you really from? And that's a loaded question, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, for some people, it's not a hard question. My father was born in a town and died in the same town. He went to England to study law in between, but when he was at home, in the place he grew up, if you asked him where he was from, he'd have just said here. And it wouldn't have been a difficult question for him. Because I grew up in the very same town as my father, but happened to have been born somewhere else, if you ask me the question where I was born, you probably won't get the answer that you want. I mean, most people, if you ask them where they're born, they'll tell you that, yeah, that's where I was born and that's where I'm from. But I'm not, I left England when I was 1.5 and went to Ghana. So my sort of first place, the place that I remember first, is Ghana. But I don't live there anymore. I don't have a strong sense of continuing connection because my parents aren't alive anymore. So I think it's harder for some people than others. But for me, yes, it's. I mean, if you ask me where I feel at home right now, I'd say, well, I'm at home in New York City. Thank you very much.
Right. When you were born, the birth announcement made world news.
Yes. It. I remember my children, my sisters, and I, when we were children, were always astonished by my parents had these collections of scrap albums of newspapers and covering various family doings. But because my mother's father had been a member of the British cabinet, Chancellor of the Exchequer after the war, and because my father's family were connected with the royal family in Ashanti, where I grew up, his father was both the brother-in-law and the secretary of the king of Ashanti, and later on the next king was my uncle by marriage. So they came from these somewhat elite backgrounds, and in the 1950s in England, it wasn't very common for Africans and Europeans to marry, and it particularly wasn't common if they were from sort of elite backgrounds. So people used to tell me that this was the first interracial society wedding in England, and then members of Parliament came, and so on. Members of the House of Lords came because my great-grandfather was a member of the House of Lords, and I think. So that's probably why it interested people. Of course, it interested people in very different ways. It was discussed in the South African Parliament, where they took it to be signs of the rapid moral decline of Britain, that this was even allowed, as it wouldn't have been in South Africa. And in Missouri, I discovered the other day, somebody wrote a poem condemning my mother for marrying a black man and circulated it, selling the pamphlet for, I think he sold 50... 50 for a dollar. So he didn't think it was hugely valuable, but he did circulate this poem addressing. So I think all around the world, people sort of thought about this as a in the way that they thought about race wherever they were, which of course was very differently in different places. The wedding was covered in a very positive way in Ebony magazine.
So when it comes to the subtitle of the book, Rethinking Identity, for you, the first steps in that rethinking are what?
Well, I think, first of all, that in each of the cases of the... So I talk a lot about gender and sexual orientation, religion, race, nationality, class, and culture as sources of identity. And I say some general things which would apply to lots of other identities. I think the first thing in each of them is to first of all, to understand them, I think, historically, to understand that the way that we think it's natural to think about these things now is actually the result of a history, and that people used to think about them differently, and that we could choose to think about them in new ways, that we're not stuck. Second, I think there's a tendency in all of them to suppose that these identities fix the people who have them more strongly than I think they actually do, because people are multifarious, and white people aren't all the same, black people aren't all the same, men aren't all the same, women aren't all the same, and gay people aren't all the same, and straight people aren't all the same, and so on. And these, this means that very often when we put one of these identity labels on someone, we, as it were, think we've pinned them down, and we haven't. And that's bad enough when you're treating other people, but of course it's terrible if you do it to yourself, if you hold yourself back from living the life that you would choose to lead if you felt free, because you think that your identity traps you into having to do this, that, or the other. I think that we should respond to our identities not by giving them up, but by shaping them to the lives we want to lead. And that means we have to begin by recognizing that different people will use them in different ways. There are, you know, there's three or four billion ways of being a man. You know, not everybody's a man in the same way.
You break up the book. You touched on this. You break up the book in five ways: creed, country, color, class, and culture. And those five give you the opportunity really to dig in with the various issues and how ultimately to rethink this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I think, you know, take, say, class. Americans are often uneasy in talking about class, though actually, if you ask most Americans, they will, in fact, answer the question. So there's a social survey that goes out, and it asks people, are you upper class, are you middle class, are you working class, or are you lower class? I don't know why they chose those categories, but that's what they do. And, you know, some 5% of Americans say they're upper class. About just under 50% say they're middle class, and a bunch of people identify as working class and as lower class. So Americans on the whole have a sense of a class identity. And what I don't think they have is much sense, shared sense of what it means. And that fits very well with my main point, which is that somebody is working class, or identifies as working class, doesn't really tell you a huge amount about them, any particular person. We can make generalizations that are interesting, but if you're talking to a particular person, if you're responding to a particular person, a particular working class person, so a white working class woman could say, I voted for Hillary Clinton because I'm a white woman, and a white working class woman could say, I voted for Donald Trump because I'm a white woman. You know, you can't tell what people's politics are going to be just by picking out a class identity. So I think class is real. And one of the, and I want to say sort of two important, draw attention to two important things about class, I think. One is that in this country, we think that it's okay to have differences in income, provided that it's the result of meritocracy, provided that the big incomes go to people who somehow deserve them because they worked hard and had talent. And one of the things that I want to insist on, just as a matter of fact, is that our society is not in that sense meritocratic. If you have a society in which as many people from the top 1% of the income distribution as from the bottom 60% get admitted to Harvard, you can't tell me that that's a result of effort and talent. I just don't believe that the amount of effort and talent in the bottom 60% of the American population is much less than that in the top 1% of the income distribution. So people are getting ahead for reasons other than effort and talent. Obviously, we know this. That's why people pay for expensive schooling for their children. They're not doing it without an awareness that it gives them an advantage over others. So I think the first thing I want to say is if we're discussing inequality in our country, we need to be realistic about what the facts are. And the facts are that we may be more meritocratic than we used to be, but we're not really a meritocracy. But the second, a lot of people already know this, but the second and more interesting thing, I think, is that if we were a meritocracy, there'd still be a problem, I think. Because if you have some people with vast incomes and huge respect, huge honor in the society, people who have all the social rewards, and some people who have very little of that, there's going to be a situation in which people at the bottom feel that they're sort of not worthwhile, that they're somehow worthless because there was this fair competition and they lost. And I think that we need to create a society which I don't think we need to have a society which everybody has the same amount of income. And I'm in favor of having differentials in honor. I think it's good to honor people who've achieved things. But we've got to have that, combine that with not denying respect to ordinary people who've done their thing. They have the talents they have. They have the experience they've had the luck they've had, and they haven't gotten a lot of money and honor, but they're still our fellow citizens. They're still worthy of respect. And I think the idea that meritocracy means that we can just sort of say, well, the system was fair, so we can just look down on the people who didn't make it, I think that's morally bad. I think it produces a society which denies something very important, which is the fundamental moral equality of everybody, whether they're successful or not.
The name of the new book is The Whys That Bind, Rethinking Identity. Kwame Anthony Appiah is the author of the book. You write in the introduction, there's no dispensing with identities, but we need to understand them better if we can hope to reconfigure them and free ourselves from mistakes about them that are often a couple of hundred years old. We live with those mistakes for a long time.
Yes, well, we're a slow species. We're the fastest species intellectually on the planet, but you know, there must be other creatures in the galaxy looking down on us with contempt, because it takes a very long time for the good ideas that human beings are constantly coming up with to percolate, I think. And it's so many things change basically because a new generation grows up thinking differently and the old generation dies thinking what they have always thought. I wrote a book about change, social change once, about a book about honor and social change. And in many of the social transitions that I talked about, the end of slavery, the end of foot binding, the end of dueling, and so on, in many of these cases, it took about 20 years. Well, that's a generation for the big shift to happen. And we're seeing this, of course, now. Young people grow up today with radically different attitudes to LGBTQ people from the attitudes that their parents and grandparents grew up with. And that just means that for many of them, the homophobia of the past isn't just wrong, it's actually puzzling. They find it hard to make sense of. They don't understand it. They say, you know, they sort of look at you, if you express homophobic thoughts, they look at you the way you look at someone who sort of announces that the earth is flat. They just think, how could you think that? Many of them. So I think these changes do take time, but and I'm not saying there's been no progress in our thinking about any of these things since the 19th century. That would be a massive overstatement, the sort of overstatement that the president goes in for. But it is true that a lot of what's wrong with our thinking about these things has been sort of recognized for quite a while. And so a lot of what I'm saying is won't come as news to people who work on these things, the people who think about religion professionally, the people who think about race professionally, the people who think about class and gender and so on. But I'm trying to sort of share the good news, really, with everybody, because I think the good news is that if we understand these identities properly, they can be useful. They don't have to be put limits on us. They can be useful, and they can bind us together. That's part of the point about the lies that bind. They can bind us together to do useful things. If we misunderstand them, we risk allowing them to bind us together to the past and also to doing bad things. So I don't think you can be against the use of identity in our political and our public lives. You can only be against bad uses and in favor of good uses.
So talk a little bit about the division of what divides us and how ultimately we eradicate those divisions, because, as you write, it can be so many different things that cause those divisions, but ultimately it comes down to the misunderstanding and the fear of the other, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, we're sort of tribal creatures. You know, sometimes it's useful because it holds a family together or it holds a community together against some threat. But in a world like ours, where there's so much interdependency and we're nearly 8 billion people now and we all need each other because of the climate, because of trade, because of the threat of warfare and so on, in a situation like that, we've got to learn to not to abandon our identities, but to live with people of other identities and to recognize, I think, that we ourselves are creatures of complex identity. So I'm an American citizen, but that doesn't stop me interacting with all kinds of people around the world because, for example, there are roughly 190 nations in the world, and there are philosophers in every one of them. And I can interact with people as philosophers. We don't have to be Americans to do philosophy together. And I think that remembering that you have many identities, so that when you're talking to someone and you're beginning to focus on what divides you, it's a good exercise to step back and say, so okay, yes, we're of different, say, political parties, but there are lots of things we have in common. And let's remember that as we proceed. One of the great ways in which groups of different identity can sort of learn to get along is by doing things together. And that, I think, is a really important difficulty about our society at the moment, which is that there's a kind of geographical segregation of people of different political views. A lot of people live in communities where people of their background, people of their sort of class and race, have pretty homogeneous political views. And so they don't spend a lot of time hanging out with people who are, if they're Republicans, with Democrats, if they're Democrats, with Republicans, if they're independents, with either. And as a result, they don't have the kind of friendly relations that you have with people that you hang out with because you're organizing a little league together or going to football games together, that kind of thing, sort of things people do. I'm not talking about professional football games. I'm talking about the football games, you know, right, in the community, at the school, right, high school. And those things, you know, if you're doing those things together, then, of course, you have lots of things in common. And when it comes out that one of you is a Democrat, one is a Republican, you also remember that, well, that's so-and-so's dad or mum. Mm. And, you know, that child, she's a friend of my son's. And I think, so one of the difficulties we face in our political divisions in this country, and in, to some extent in our racial divisions, is that we don't spend enough time with each other, not doing politics, but doing all the other things that bring people together in communities. And I don't know how to solve that, because it's a consequence of residential segregation, I mean, self-segregation, people choosing to live in communities of like-minded people. And this applies just as much to class as it does to race. Many of the best high schools in this country are public high schools in rich communities. Lots of people who aren't rich would like to live in those communities just because they have good schools, but they can't afford to live there. So that means that the people in the high school come from a rather homogeneous class background. The old days, the point of the public school was that people came from all backgrounds together. So I think, you know, we need to work to organize our lives, to think about how to make sure that in our lives we spend more time with our fellow citizens if we want to be able to bond together. And in doing that, it's helpful to remember that we are, for example, not just Republicans and Democrats, but also Americans. Not just Republicans and Democrats, but also, you know, Albanians and New Yorkers and people from Illinois and Los Angeles. We have things we share always, as well as the things that divide us.
My final question for you is, As I noted in the introduction, you pen the ethicist column for the New York Times. Do you find yourself at an intersection of identity and the issues that you write about in this book and the ethical quandaries that you are presented to by the writers to your column?
I think the main way, I mean, obviously people ask me questions sometimes that have to do with sexism and racism and so on, so, and identity obviously comes into those. But the main way, I think, in which I sometimes feel that identity matters is actually my own, you know, I can only answer the questions by thinking from my own, you know, from standing where I stand. And on certain kinds of issues, my background in Ghana, my growing up in Ghana, makes my instincts, I think, slightly different from those of some Americans, because where I grew up is a very, I would say, sort of communal place. And, for example, many people in this country have an extremely proprietary attitude to their children. They don't really want anybody except people that they have authorized to interact with their children. But in where I grew up, any adult, if you were on the street and you were in difficulty, any adult would assume that it was their job to help you, to look after you, and you would have assumed that too. So you would have expected adults who were around to take care of you. So I have, you know, that sort of thing where I feel my own instinct is different from that of some people in this country. But when I say that, of course, it's only some people, because this country includes people from all over the world. And the range of views about these questions in this country is actually quite vast. So sometimes what I think I want to do is to say to people, well, you know, you have to recognize that you're responding out of your tradition, and we're living in a country of many different traditions, and so we have to figure out how to live together while recognizing that we come at these things somewhat differently.
The name of the book is The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity. It is published by Liverite. Anthony, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity by Kwame Anthony Appiah. The book is published by Liverite. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.